their software to design and build internal applications. I sat down with my development team and told them I knew they couldn't do it using the same old way of developing software. That old methodology was the waterfall method I described in the last chapter. Everything related to a project carefully laid out on those massive Gantt charts. Every task measured out precisely in hours, highlighted in pretty colors flowing down the page like a waterfall. Those charts were beautiful in their precision. They were also complete fabrications. At ESOL, I knew the waterfall methodology would put us months, if not years, past our deadline. We had to come up with a completely different way of doing things. I went to the CEO and told him we were scrapping the Gantt chart. He was shocked and demanded to know why. "How many Gantt charts have you seen in your career?" I asked. "Hundreds," he replied. "How many of them were right?" He paused. "None." That's when I told him I was going to give him working software at the end of the month instead of a broken Gantt chart. He could try it out for himself and see if we were on track. We had to try it if we were going to meet our deadline. My team and I spent a few weeks reading hundreds of papers and books and articles on the organization of teams and product development. Then one day, one of the developers came in with a Harvard Business Review paper from 1986, written by two Japanese business professors, Hirotaka Takeuchi and Ikujiro Nonaka. It was titled, "The New Product Development Game." Takeuchi and Nonaka had looked at teams from some of the world's most productive and innovative companies: Honda, Fuji Xerox, 3M, Hewlett-Packard, and others. They argued that the old way of doing product development, typified by NASA's phased program planning system, a waterfall system, was fundamentally flawed. Instead, the best companies used an overlapping development process that was faster and more flexible. The teams were cross-functional. The teams had autonomy. They were empowered to make their own decisions. And they had a transcendent purpose. They were reaching for something bigger than themselves. Management didn't dictate. Instead, executives were servant leaders and facilitators focused on getting obstacles out of their team's way rather than telling them what and how to do product development. The Japanese professors compared the team's work to that of a rugby team and said the best teams acted as though they were in a scrum. The ball gets passed within the team as it moves as a unit up the field. Takeuchi and Onaka's paper made a splash when it was first published, but that was 7 years before we were reading the paper at ESOL. Everyone had admired it, but no one had done anything with it. The average American manager was unable to make sense of it, even though Toyota was rapidly increasing market share using this approach. At ESOL, we had nothing to lose. We decided to try it, even though the paper focused on manufacturing, not software development. I thought their ideas tapped into something fundamental, a descriptive process of how humans work together best in any endeavor. It flowed into all the other experiments I'd conducted, going back to my first job in the private sector at Mid-Continent. This was the formal birth of Scrum. We developed the product at ESOL on schedule within 6 months, under budget, and with fewer bugs than any previous delivery. I got so excited about the possibilities of this new form of project management that all my future work focused on refining Scrum for companies. In 1995, I presented a paper with Ken Schwaber called Scrum Development Process, which codified those practices at an Association for Computing Machinery Research Conference. Since then, we have tweaked the idea a little bit, but the fundamental principles are the same, and those companies that embrace the process typically see immediate benefits. Inspect and adapt. Scrum teams that work well are able to achieve what we call hyper-productivity. It's hard to believe, but we regularly see somewhere between a 300 to 400% improvement in productivity among groups that implement Scrum well. The best teams can achieve productivity increases of up to 800% and replicate that success over and over again. They also end up more than doubling the quality of their work. So how do you build autonomy, transcendence, and cross-fertilization into a Scrum team, and from that combination achieve hyper-productivity? Well, That's what the rest of this book is about, but I'm going to lay out the basic structure here. You can also hear it laid out in short form in the appendix. Since Scrum comes out of techniques used in Japanese manufacturing, it pays to learn a bit about where the Japanese learned them. Ironically, they learned them from an American, W. Edwards Deming. Deming worked for General Douglas MacArthur during the American occupation of Japan after World War II. MacArthur's approach to rebuilding the economy was to fire most of the senior management in Japanese companies, promote line managers from the ranks, and bring in business operations experts like Deming from the United States. Deming's influence on Japanese manufacturing was dramatic. He trained hundreds of engineers in what is called statistical process control. The basic idea is to measure exactly what is being done and how well, and to strive for continuous improvement. Don't just get better once, get better constantly. Always be looking for something to improve. Never, ever settle for where you are. How you get there is to be constantly creating experiments to see if you can achieve improvement. If I try this method, is it better? How about this one? What if I change just this one thing? Deming famously gave a talk to Japanese business leaders in 1950. In the audience were people like Akio Morita, the founder of Sony. In that talk, Deming told them, "No matter how excellent your technicians, you who are leaders must strive for advances in the improvement of product quality and uniformity if your technicians are to be able to make improvements. The first step, therefore, belongs with management. First, your company technicians and your factories must know that you have a fervor for advancing product quality and uniformity and a sense of responsibility for product quality. Nothing will come of this if you only speak about it. Action is important." And the method to take action, and perhaps what Deming is most famous for, is the PDCA cycle. Plan, do, check, act. You can apply this cycle to the production of just about anything, be it a car, a video game, or heck, even a paper airplane. When I train people how to do Scrum, that's what I use, paper airplanes. I divide people up into teams and tell them that the goal is to build as many paper airplanes as they can that will fly across the room. There are going to be three roles on the team. One person will check how many planes are built that can actually fly. Another will work as part of the assembly process, but will also pay attention to the process itself and look for ways that the team can make better airplanes and speed up their production. Everyone else will concentrate on building as many planes that can actually fly the distance in the assembly time allowed. I then say we're going to do 3 6-minute cycles of paper airplane building. The teams have 1 minute each cycle to plan how they're going to build the airplane, 3 minutes to do, to build and test as many airplanes as they can that can actually fly, and finally, they'll have 2 minutes to check. In this phase, the team looks for how they could improve their paper airplane building process. What went right? What went wrong? Should the design be changed? How can the construction process be improved? And then they will act. In Deming's world, to act means to change your way of working based on real results and real environmental input. It's the same strategy used by Brooks Robot. Go through this cycle 3 times, and whether you're making paper airplanes or actual spaceships, you'll get better, significantly better, on the order of 2 to 3 times faster with at least double the quality. This PDCA cycle, a radical idea when Deming pitched it to the Japanese, is how Toyota became the number one car company in the world. And it's how any sort of lean manufacturing, the American term for using the concepts of the Toyota production system, or Scrum product development is done. Change or die. Part of the reason a new way of doing things was so imperative and why such a broad swath of companies have adopted it is because the state of software development was so bad. Projects were almost always late, over budget, and often simply didn't work. And that wasn't because the people were stupid or greedy. Rather, it had to do with the way they thought about their work. They insisted on the waterfall method, insisted that everything could be planned ahead of time, even insisted that things wouldn't change over the course of a multi-year project. That's just insane on the face of it. I learned this firsthand at Bell South when I visited them as a consultant years ago. They had top-notch engineers, many from the famous Bell Labs. They executed Waterfall perfectly. They'd bid on huge $10 to $20 million projects. They'd gather all the requirements from the customer, then go away for 18 months and deliver on time and on budget exactly what the customer had asked for. They were one of the very, very few companies in the entire world that could pull that off. The problem was, at that point, the customer no longer wanted what they had said they wanted. Circumstances had changed. Business cycles were getting shorter, and customers were demanding more responsive services. I was brought in to see if I could help Bell South figure out what they were doing wrong. I soon realized it was the entire way they were working. This can be tough to hear when it seems as if you're doing everything right. So one day I stood before a room full of 150 Bell South engineers and told them that unless they changed to a different, more customer-responsive model, they wouldn't last as a going concern. The crowd was tough. They were all really smart men and women, but they believed my ideas were just another management fad. I couldn't get through to them, so I just shrugged and left them with a final warning. Change or die. As you may have noticed, Bell South isn't around anymore. Shu Ha Ri. Scrum has its roots in Japanese thought and practice. When I traveled to Japan recently to meet with Professor Ikujiro Nonaka, he made it clear to me that in Japan, Scrum isn't seen as the latest work fad. They regard it as a way of doing, a way of being, a way of life. When I teach people how to do Scrum, I often talk about my own personal experience studying the Japanese martial art of Aikido over the years. Scrum, like Aikido, or heck, like the tango, is something that you can only really learn by doing. Your body and your mind and your spirit become aligned through constant practice and improvement. In the martial arts, you learn a concept called Shu Ha Ri, which points to different levels of mastery. In the Shu state, you know all the rules and the forms. You repeat them, like the steps in a dance, so your body absorbs them. You don't deviate at all. In the Ha state, once you've mastered the forms, you can make innovations. Put an extra swing in your step down the dance floor. In the Ri state, you're able to discard the forms. You've truly mastered the practice. And you're able to be creative in an unhindered way because the knowledge of the meaning of Aikido or the tango is so deeply embedded in you, your every step expresses its essence. Scrum is a lot like that. It requires practice and attention, but also a continuous effort to reach a new state, a state where things just flow and happen. If you've ever watched great dancers or gymnasts, you know that their motion can almost seem effortless. As if they're doing nothing but simply being. They seem as if they couldn't be doing anything else but what they are in that moment. I experienced that one day when a diminutive Aikido master threw me effortlessly through the air, and yet did so in a way that caused me to fall gently to the mat, as though I were a baby being gently placed in a cradle. That's what you want to get to with Scrum. That's the state I want everyone to get to in their lives. Work doesn't have to suck. It can flow. It can be an expression of joy, alignment toward a higher purpose. We can be better. We can be great. We just have to practice. For the rest of this book, I'm going to spend each chapter focusing on one particular aspect of Scrum. These deep dives are meant to give you the reasoning behind the concepts and why Scrum is structured the way it is. You will hear implementing Scrum, a definitive description of Scrum, in the appendix. But it just tells you what to do. If you'll come along with me, I'll tell you why. The takeaway. Hesitation is death. Observe, orient, decide, act. Know where you are, assess your options, make a decision, and act. Look outward for answers. Complex adaptive systems follow a few simple rules, which they learn from their environment. Great teams are. They are cross-functional, autonomous, and empowered with a transcendent purpose. Don't guess. Plan, do, check, act. Plan what you're going to do. Do it. Check whether it did what you wanted. Act on that and change how you're doing things. Repeat in regular cycles. and, by doing so, achieve continuous improvement. Shu Ha Ri. First, learn the rules and the forms, and once you've mastered them, make innovations. Finally, in a heightened state of mastery, discard the forms and just be, with all the learning internalized and decisions made almost unconsciously. Chapter 3. Teams. Teams are what get things done in the world of work. There are teams that make cars, answer phones, do surgery, program computers, put the news on, and burst through the doors of apartments occupied by terrorists. Certainly, there are artisans or artists who do work by themselves, but teams are what make the world go round, and they're what Scrum is based on. Everyone knows this, but in business, we all too often focus solely on individuals, even if production is a team effort. Think of performance bonuses or promotions or hiring. Everything is focused on the individual actor rather than the team. And that, it turns out, is a big mistake. Managers tend to focus on the individual because it makes intuitive sense. You want the best people, and people are different. So focus on getting the best performers and you'll get better results, right? Well, it's not quite that simple. Take, for example, the process by which students receive grades in a class. At Yale University, a computer programming course taught by Professor Stanley Eisenstadt, CS323, is notoriously hard. When students began complaining about how long each assignment took, the professor didn't make his assignments easier, but he did start tracking how long each student needed to complete them. Then Joel Spolsky, who was in Eisenstadt's course back in the 1980s and now has his own software business, compared that data to the actual grades people were getting. He wanted to know if there was any correlation between the time spent on a project and the grade the student received. Interestingly, there isn't. Some people work quickly and get an A, and some people work meticulously and get the same grade. The only difference is the amount of time spent. So what is the application for business? Well, if you're a manager, it seems that you want to hire not just the workers who earn A's, but those who earn them in the shortest amount of time. In the Yale study, the fastest students outpaced their slow compatriots by a ratio of 10 to 1. They were 10 times faster, and they got just as good a grade. 10 times faster is pretty dramatic, right? So it seems that companies should focus on hiring the quickest people and weeding out the slow-footed. That sounds like the best approach to increasing productivity. But other factors can be even more crucial. If you look at teams instead of individuals, you see something interesting. There are studies that looked at some 3,800 different projects, ranging from work done at accounting firms to software development for battleships to tech projects at IBM. The analysts didn't look at individual performance data, but rather team performance data. And when you examine how the teams did, you see something surprising. If the best team could perform a task in 1 week, how long do you think it would take the worst team? You might guess the same ratio as was observed at Yale, 10 to 1. That is, the slow team took more than 2 months to accomplish what the fast team knocked off in a week. The actual answer, though, is that there is a much larger difference in team performance than there is in individual performance. It actually didn't take the slow team 10 weeks to do what the best team could do in 1 week. Rather, it took them 2,000 weeks. That's how great the difference is between the best and the worst. So where should you focus your attention? At the level of the individual, where you might be able to get an improvement of 10 times if you can magically make all your employees geniuses, or at the team level, boosting productivity by an enormous magnitude even if you merely make your worst teams mediocre. Of course, aiming for mediocrity will get you just that. But what if you could make all your teams great? At certain times, in certain places, with certain small groups of people, everything becomes possible. Even if you've never been on a team like that, you've seen them in action. You hear stories about them. Legends are told about what they can do. I grew up near Boston and live there now. So some of the great teams that come to my mind are the Celtics of the 1980s or the New England Patriots of the Tom Brady era. When those teams were on, it seemed as if they were playing a different game than everyone else. Drives and plays that had once seemed undoable suddenly became part of the game plan. It was as if a state of grace had descended upon those players, and for a moment, they could do no wrong. Larry Bird would drive down the court and pass the ball, without looking, toward what seemed to be empty hardwood, but just as the ball was headed out of bounds, Kevin McHale would simply appear exactly where he was supposed to be. And then he'd throw the ball to the side, again, seemingly without looking, and Robert Parrish would happen to be perfectly positioned for a shot. That absolute alignment of purpose and trust is something that creates greatness. We've all seen those teams. Some of us have been lucky enough to be on one, or more than one, over the course of our lives. When I was designing Scrum, I looked at what super-performing teams had that other teams didn't. Why is it, I wondered, that some teams change the world and others are mired in mediocrity? What are the common elements that truly great teams have? And most important, can we reproduce them? The answer, it turns out, is yes. In their original paper that described what became Scrum, the new product development game, Professors Takeuchi and Nonaka described the characteristics of the teams they saw at the best companies in the world. 1. Transcendent. They have a sense of purpose beyond the ordinary. The self-realized goal allows them to move beyond the ordinary into the extraordinary. In a very real way, the very decision to not be average but to be great changes the way they view themselves and what they're capable of. 2. Autonomous. The teams are self-organizing and self-managing. They have the power to make their own decisions about how to do their jobs and are empowered to make those decisions stick. 3. Cross-functional. The teams have all the skills needed to complete the project. Planning, design, production, sales, distribution, and those skills feed and reinforce each other. As one team member that designed a revolutionary new camera for Canon described it, when all the team members are located in one large room, someone's information becomes yours without even trying. You then start thinking in terms of what's best or second best for the group at large, and not only where you stand. So how do you create a team that aims for a higher goal, organizes itself, and constantly feeds off each member's skills? I spent a lot of time pondering that. After all, you can't just yell at people to be more self-organized and transcendent. The motivation has to come from within. Imposing it will kill what you're trying to do. Might there be a simple set of rules that encourage the formation of magic? The Long Gray Line. I thought back to when I was part of one of those magical teams. It was in the early 1960s when I was a cadet at the United States Military Academy, more commonly known as West Point. During my last year there, I was appointed training officer to my cadet company, L2, the Loose Deuce. In 1963, there were 24 companies at West Point, A1 through M1 and A2 through M2. 3 times a week, these companies took to the parade field and marched in full dress uniform with rifles held thus and swords so and white straps here and gear placed carefully there. These parade formations have been a competition at the academy for almost 200 years. In 1963, the Loose Deuce had been at the bottom of those rankings for more than a century. The training officer has no direct power. He isn't part of the command structure of the company. No one answers to him. No one has to do what he says. But after each parade, the training officers get together and rate each company according to various criteria. As training officer of the Loose Deuce, I decided that what I could do was make things more transparent. I made colored charts of what went right and what went wrong and posted them in the barracks where everyone in my company would have to see them every day. At first, the criticisms were simple. Charlie had his sword stuck in the dirt. Jim didn't turn in sync with everyone else. Dave's salute was sloppy. There were no punishments or blame. It was simply facts laid out by all the other training officers that were brought up during evaluations. Yet these were the reasons L2 was rated at the bottom. Within just a few weeks, the cadets sharpened their game, and the low ratings now pointed to the company commander. His orders weren't clear enough. The timing wasn't crisp enough. Not surprisingly, I got heat for criticizing the commander. But I said simply in response, "The ratings are the ratings. I'm just showing you what they are. The ranks have pulled their shit together. You are now the problem. Do you want to fix it, or do you want to suck forever? A few weeks later, L2 was the number one company at West Point. The most honored cadet in West Point's history was General Douglas MacArthur. He had the highest ranking of any cadet who graduated there, and he was a leading officer in both World Wars. As a five-star general and Medal of Honor winner, he had a special connection to the Corps of Cadets. The year before I was training my company, in May of 1962, he gave his final speech at West Point. You have to picture the scene properly to get the full impact. There were 3,000 men in cadet gray uniforms sitting in this gargantuan stone hall with vast columns and giant chandeliers hanging down from the high ceiling. About 30 feet up on one wall was a platform that overlooked the hall. General MacArthur, then Frail, stood on that platform and gave today what is referred to as the Long Gray Line speech, gray being the color of the cadets' uniforms. You are the leaven which binds together the entire fabric of our national system of defense. From your ranks come the great captains who hold the nation's destiny in their hands the moment the war tocsin sounds. The Long Gray Line has never failed us. Were you to do so, a million ghosts in olive drab, in brown khaki, in blue and gray would rise from their white crosses thundering those magic words, duty, honor, country. At that, I remember, it felt as if a legion of those ghosts rose up behind MacArthur as he left the Corps with his final charge, and 3,000 men, trained for war, to whom tears did not come easily, began to cry. In my dreams, I hear again the crash of guns, the rattle of musketry, the strange, mournful mutter of the battlefield. But in the evening of my memory, I come back to West Point. Always there echoes and re-echoes, duty, honor, country. Today marks my final roll call with you, but I want you to know that when I cross the river, my last conscious thoughts will be of the Corps and the Corps and the Corps. To this day, every cadet at the academy has to memorize that speech, line by line, word for word, before they can graduate. That speech has become the spiritual guide for the cadet corps and for the U.S. officer corps at large. Duty, honor, country. Almost a year after that speech, General MacArthur died. One company was selected to march at his funeral. To the slow, rhythmic sound of the drums, the Loose Deuce, the same company that had been the worst in the Corps for more than 100 years, marched behind the caisson carrying the casket of one of America's greatest generals. A few months after that funeral, I marched with the Loose Deuce for the last time at my graduation. All 24 companies marched, but L2, because of our position in the alphabet, marched 23rd. After the ceremony, my future father-in-law asked me, "That company, the second to last one, they were different than all the rest. The others were marching. They seemed to be floating. Who were they?" "That was my company," I told him. "Those men buried General MacArthur. My company had achieved transcendence." Scrum in the time of revolt. Often when people talk about great teams, they only talk about that transcendent sense of purpose. But while that's a critical element, it's only one leg of the three-legged stool. Just as critical, but perhaps less celebrated, is the freedom to do your job in the way that you think best, to have autonomy. On all great teams, it's left to the members to decide how to carry out the goals set by those leading the organization. Tahrir Square has become synonymous with the Egyptian Revolution and the ongoing struggles in that country. But before January of 2011, it was just another dirty, traffic-clogged rotary in downtown Cairo. To the north lies the Rose Red Egyptian Museum, and to the south, the high walls of the American University in Cairo and the iconic Mukawama government building. The headquarters of the National Democratic Party of the Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak was on the west, as was the Arab League headquarters. Oddly, at the square's eastern edge was, of all things, a KFC, which soon became the backdrop to stone-throwing protesters pushing back police. In late January of 2011, a small group of protesters, decided to demonstrate within the traffic circle to protest the brutal killing of a young man named Khaled Said by Egyptian police. What might have been another small protest against a repressive regime caught fire, ignited the Egyptian imagination, and eventually drew millions to the square. Over the next month, the unthinkable happened. Just by people gathering and saying no, one of the oldest and most powerful dictatorial regimes in the Middle East fell. The people gathered day after day, night after night, filling the square and creating an alternate country where the dictator Hosni Mubarak did not rule and individuals could actually speak their minds. They changed their world. For journalists, it was a massive story of historical significance. Among those descending on Cairo was National Public Radio, one of the premier journalism outfits in the United States. Caught flat-footed at first, producers and reporters for NPR blew deadlines, missed stories, and scrambled to meet the demands of executives back in Washington. J.J. Sutherland, my son, was sent to fix it. A longtime war correspondent and producer, he was assigned to Cairo to make the coverage work. The story was too big not to be on the air every single day, every single show, and every single hour. JJ dropped into a country where the airports had been closed, foreigners were desperately trying to flee, and the cell phone network and internet had been shut down. He was the senior producer on the scene, but, much like a training officer at West Point, an NPR producer is a facilitator, an organizer, a helper or booster rather than a typical manager or leader. JJ's job was to help the team do the best work they could. It wasn't to tell them what to do. Rather, it was to provide them with what they needed. The orders from management were to tell the story and to be on the air multiple times a day. And the team on the ground figured out how to meet that challenge, deciding what stories to tell and how to tell them using the medium of radio. Oddly, it was precisely because it was so difficult to communicate with executives back in Washington that the team was so successful. In a very real way, they were on their own. With constant direct oversight by Washington being impossible and events happening so fast, the team had to organize themselves to get the work done. One of the key concepts in Scrum is that the team members decide themselves how they're going to do the work. It's management's responsibility to set the strategic goals, but it's the team's job to decide how to reach those goals. In Cairo, there was no way anyone not on the ground could even keep up with what was happening. Almost daily, the NPR team would report a series of stories for the next day that would be rendered instantly obsolete by rapidly unfolding events. There'd be a major clash in the square, a speech, a resignation, or a battle, and all the team's work would be for naught. Suddenly, they'd be scrambling to get something timely on the air. They succeeded by using Scrum. Their deadlines called for them to report every 12 hours on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Each cycle, JJ would talk to the team and ask three very simple questions. What did you do since the last time we talked? What are you going to do before we talk again? And what is getting in your way? His asking those questions, which is one of the regular rituals of Scrum, forced the correspondents to talk and share with one another. And JJ's main job, as de facto Scrum Master, was to make sure that those things getting in the team's way at one meeting were gone by the next. The impediment could be anything, from dealing with Egyptian bureaucracy to getting a secure hotel room, from finding drivers and translators to getting correspondents out of the custody of Egypt's feared secret police, the Mukhabarat. How did it all work out? Well, what had begun in chaos, personal disputes, and a failure to deliver the news quickly became a well-oiled machine that management didn't even have to manage. Instead, team members managed themselves. Over the next few weeks, NPR's squad in Cairo produced more coverage than anyone thought possible. And it was of higher quality than what the competition was offering, eventually winning several awards. It was a feat that wouldn't have been accomplished had the team not been imbued with a sense of purpose to tell one of the biggest stories of their careers, and not possessed autonomy, the ability to decide for themselves how to produce the many threads of that overall story. Now, Scrum is being used all over the place at NPR. From web design to data journalism to creating new radio shows. Teams at the Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Washington Post, and ProPublica are all using Scrum. When deadlines are tight, they just need the speed. One team to get the job done. The third leg of the stool for great teams is that they have all the skills necessary to get things done. In a classically organized structure, you might have the team of planners, followed by the team of builders, followed by the team of testers, followed by the production team, followed by the shipping team. Each team along the way has to finish its piece of the action before the project can move to the next step. No one team by itself can actually get a product out the door. The classic example of this was NASA's phase gate process. This was how they ran the shuttle program and other efforts in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's very different now, but here's how their old process worked. First, there's a discovery phase, where people decide what they're going to try to accomplish. Maybe it's build a rocket that goes to the moon. A bunch of strategists sit in a room and fantasize about it. Then there's a gate, where a manager or group of managers has to sign off on the project as worthy of pursuing. Then there's a scoping phase, where all the requirements people decide what the thing is going to do. Then there's another gate, and another set of meetings, and then these humongous documents are handed off to the next phase, building the business case and the project plan. Then all these plans are taken to another set of meetings and approvals, and after that, handed off to yet another phase, the development phase, where the thing is actually built. Then there's another bunch of meetings and documents, and the product is handed off to a whole other group for the next phase, testing. Those people have never seen the product before, but they test it, sign off that it's right, and then push it to another gate, or set of interminable meetings, with another bunch of documents that no one has read. And then, and only then, is the product passed to a sixth group of people who will actually launch it. It's exhausting just writing about it, and this is how NASA used to build things. At one point in the early 1980s, executives from Fuji Xerox traveled to America to study how the famous space agency did things. When they implemented the same procedures back in Japan, they immediately saw quality drop, the failure rate go up, and their ability to deliver sink like a stone. They quickly abandoned the process, saying it was likely to produce catastrophic error. The Rogers Commission, that examined the 1986 Challenger disaster, agreed. As physicist Richard Feynman famously wrote in Appendix F of the Commission's report, "It would appear that, for whatever purpose, be it for internal or external consumption, the management of NASA exaggerates the reliability of its product to the point of fantasy." The fact is, when you look at the best teams, like the ones that existed at Toyota or 3M when Takeuchi or Nonaka wrote their paper, or the ones at Google or Salesforce.com or Amazon today, there isn't this separation of roles. Each team has all the people on it to do everything, soup to nuts. Nicola Durambes is in charge of agile practices at Salesforce.com. She is responsible for some 200 scrum teams at a company that is routinely on such lists as Fortune's 100 best companies to work for and Forbes' most innovative companies in the world. She says she sees Scrum as their secret sauce. "When we were a startup," she says, "we did a major release 3 or 4 times a year. As we grew and scaled up, managing projects in a typical waterfall way, that fell to once a year in 2005-2006. That had to change, so we introduced Scrum. Since then, we've been doing releases 3 times a year. There aren't that many major enterprise companies that can do that." What she looks for in a team is diversity of skill set, thinking, and experience. She wants teams that are unselfish and autonomous, but she also needs them to be cross-functional, teams that can get a whole project done. One of her tests of whether a team is on the right path comes when she asks, say, a network engineer, "What team are you on?" If he or she responds by mentioning the product they're working on, say automation or integration, rather than their specialty, such as network engineering, she nods approvingly. When a specialist identifies with their specialty more than with the product they're actually making, Durambes knows she still has work to do. Scrum at war. One of the most dramatic examples of a cross-functional team comes from the military. American Special Operations Forces operate in just this way. A typical Army Special Forces A team has 12 people, a team leader, who is a commissioned officer, a warrant officer, a team sergeant, who runs the team in day-to-day operations, an intelligence sergeant, and 2 each of sergeants in Special Forces weapons, demolition, medical, and communications. Each team has all the capabilities to carry out their mission from start to finish, and they conduct cross-training across each skill set. They want to make sure, for example, that if both of the medics get killed, the communications specialist can patch up the weapons specialist. Another way the special forces operate is that, unlike much of the regular military, they don't separate intelligence gathering and operations planning. There are no handoffs from one team to another where mistakes might be made. Special forces don't want any Challenger disasters. As a result, there's constant communication among the people collecting the intelligence, those planning what to do with it, and those who will be going through the door. During the Iraq War, Special Forces teams showed that they were exceedingly good at killing people. They could locate an insurgent target and wipe it out that same night. Between 2003 and 2007, they carried out thousands of successful missions aimed at disrupting the Iraqi insurgency, especially Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Tactically and operationally, they almost always succeeded in their missions. Their cross-functional, highly trained teams were among the most lethal forces the world had ever seen. Yet despite all their skill and talent, they had almost zero strategic impact. During those first 4 years of the war, attacks on American forces and Iraqi civilians increased almost daily. During some of the darkest days of the war, there were over 100 attacks a day on American forces, and even the lethality of the American Special Forces couldn't stem the tide. By late 2006 and early 2007, just about every informed commentator saw Iraq as a lost cause. Every additional American death started to be seen as a futile sacrifice. Then, in 2007, General David Petraeus led what became known as the Surge, which involved putting tens of thousands more troops into the country and having them live among the populace. This new strategy had a remarkable impact. One reason was that it got the Iraqi people to believe that the Americans were on their side, fighting the insurgents who were blowing up bombs in their neighborhoods and conducting ethnic cleansing. Another reason was that the American military, using a program called the Sons of Iraq, succeeded in bribing tens of thousands of former insurgents to come over to the U.S. side. But there was a third component of the strategy, something that journalist Bob Woodward called as revolutionary as the invention of the tank or the airplane. This weapon wasn't a new gizmo or unmanned drone. It was what General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command at the time, called collaborative warfare. It involved using cross-functional teams from across the entire U.S. government to target and disrupt Al-Qaeda networks. As the Washington Post described it on September 6, 2008, the Central Intelligence Agency provides intelligence analysts and spycraft with sensors and cameras that can track targets, vehicles, or equipment for up to 14 hours. Federal Bureau of Investigation forensic experts dissect data from cell phone information to the pocket litter found on extremists. Treasury officials track funds flowing among extremists and from governments. National Security Agency staffers intercept conversations and computer data, and members of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency use high-tech equipment to pinpoint where suspected extremists are using phones or computers. What they did was create a cross-functional team that had all the skills necessary to get the job done. Instead of having all these experts on separate teams rarely sharing information, they all worked together in the same room, sharing all their intelligence and planning to track down and kill Al-Qaeda operatives. Before this, an intelligence organization would designate the target, then hand off the actual operations to a special forces team. Then that team would hand over any intelligence it gathered to yet another team for analysis. Those practicing the handoff model discovered what Fuji Xerox discovered decades earlier when the Japanese tried to implement NASA's phase gate system, and it's one of the main reasons Scrum was developed in the first place. Whenever there are handoffs between teams, there's the opportunity for disaster. As an article titled Employing ISR, Special Operations Forces Best Practices and Joint Force Quarterly put it, the interagency teams made it possible to eliminate the organizational seams between the different coalition actors in Iraq, placing an unblinking eye on high-value targets. Passing responsibilities between units and organizations represented an organizational blink during which momentum slowed and the target might escape. Sharing information and resources like this isn't easy in any setting. I've seen managers almost seize up as their resources are assigned to a team outside their direct control. Giving up day-to-day micromanaging and control is hard to do, but to do it in the secretive world of intelligence and special operations is even more difficult. So difficult that despite their effectiveness, the teams in Iraq were quickly disbanded after the surge was deemed a success. Christopher Lamb and Evan Munsing wrote a fascinating article, Secret Weapon, High-Value Target Teams as an Organizational Innovation, laying this out. As soon as the near failure in Iraq was averted, bureaucratic support for interagency teams began to decline. By 2008, other departments and agencies, particularly one unidentified intelligence agency, began pulling back people and cooperation, believing information sharing and collaboration had gone too far. The most powerful weapon in America's arsenal, what Bob Woodward called as important as the invention of the tank or the airplane, was set aside because of parochial departmental concerns and the worries of middle managers who are concerned for their careers. I've seen this happen at one large financial institution in Boston repeatedly. They'll call me up in a panic when they have a mission-critical project that is in trouble. They'll have me train dozens of their people in Scrum and have me start up teams that are capable of addressing their emergency. They direct people from across the organization into cross-functional teams to address the issue, and then they solve it. Once the crisis is passed, they disband the teams to their respective silos and managerial fiefdoms. The transparency and sharing of a truly fantastic team threatens structures rooted in secrets and obfuscation. Managers often don't want other managers, their own teams, or other people within the power structure to know exactly what they're doing or what is being accomplished and how fast. They see keeping that knowledge secret as critical to their power. Instead of being aligned with the interests of the greater good, they're aligned with their own motivations, which often boil down to greed and ambition. It's the same kind of thinking that led to the massive management failure that caused the most recent economic collapse. At many companies, actions were based solely on what was in it for the individual on a short-term basis. There was no thought of what would benefit everyone or of limiting harm to the global economy. Size does matter, but not the way you think. But just because cross-functionality can achieve great results, you shouldn't play Noah and throw two of everything into a team. The team dynamic only works well in small teams. The classic formula is 7 people, plus or minus 2, though I've seen teams as small as 3 function at a high level. What's fascinating is that the data shows if you have more than 9 people on a team, their velocity actually slows down. That's right. More resources make the team go slower. In software development, there's a term called Brooks' Law that Fred Brooks coined back in 1975 in his seminal book, The Mythical Man Month. Put simply, Brooks' Law says adding manpower to a late software project makes it later. This has been borne out in study after study. Lawrence Putnam is a legendary figure in software development, and he has made it his life's work to study how long things take to make and why. His work kept showing that projects with 20 or more people on them used more effort than those with 5 or fewer. Not just a little bit, but a lot. A large team would take about 5 times the number of hours that a small team would. He saw this again and again. And in the mid-1990s, he decided to try to do a broad-based study to determine what the right team size is. So he looked at 491 medium-sized projects at hundreds of different companies. These were all projects that required new products or features to be created, not a repurposing of old versions. He divided the projects by team size and noticed something right away. Once the teams grew larger than 8, they took dramatically longer to get things done. Groups made up of 3 to 7 people required about 25% of the effort of groups of 9 to 20 to get the same amount of work done. This result recurred over hundreds and hundreds of projects. That very large groups do less seems to be an ironclad rule of human nature. But why? To answer that, we have to look at the limitations of the human brain. You've probably heard of the classic George Miller study in 1956, showing that the maximum number of items the average person can retain in their short-term memory is 7. This is supposedly why telephone numbers are 7 numbers long. The problem with Miller's work is that later research has proved him wrong. In 2001, Nelson Cowan of the University of Missouri wondered whether that magic rule of seven was really true and conducted a wide survey of all the new research on the topic. It turns out that the number of items one can retain in short-term memory isn't seven, it's four. People often think that they can memorize more than that using a mnemonic device or by just concentrating harder. But the research is fairly clear that we can only remember four chunks of data. The classic example is giving someone the following series of 12 letters. FBICBSIBMIRS. People can usually remember about four of those letters, unless they notice that they can be chunked into well-known acronyms. FBI, CBS, IBM, IRS. If you can link things in your short-term memory to long-term memory associations, you can hold more. But the part of the mind that focuses, the conscious part, can only hold about four distinct items at once. So there's a hardwired limit to what our brain can hold at any one time, which leads us back to Brooks. When he tried to figure out why adding more people to a project made it take longer, he discovered two reasons. The first is the time it takes to bring people up to speed. As you'd expect, bringing a new person up to speed slows down everyone else. The second reason has to do not only with how we think, but quite literally, with what our brains are capable of thinking. The number of communication channels increases dramatically with the number of people, and our brains just can't handle it. If you want to calculate the impact of group size, you take the number of people on a team, multiply by that number minus one, and divide by two. In other words, communication channels equals n times n minus one divided by two. So, for example, if you have five people, you have 10 channels, six people, 15 channels, 7, 21, 8, 28, 9, 36, 10, 45. Our brains simply can't keep up with that many people at once. We don't know what everyone is doing, and we slow down as we try to figure it out. Just as on a special forces team, everyone on a scrum team has to know what everyone else is doing. All the work being done, the challenges faced, the progress made, has to be transparent to everyone else. And if the team gets too big, the ability of everyone to communicate clearly with everyone else all the time gets muddled. There are too many cross currents. Often, the team socially and functionally breaks into sub-teams that begin working at cross purposes. The cross-functionality is lost. Meetings that took minutes now take hours. Don't do it. Keep your teams small. The Scrum Master. With the first scrum team, I regularly showed them a video of the All Blacks rugby team getting ready for a game. The All Blacks, a legendary team from the small country of New Zealand, are a transcendent team. Before every game, they perform the Maori warrior ceremony of the haka. The haka is a warrior dance that charges up people about to go into battle. While watching it, you can almost see the energy come out of each player and coalesce into a greater whole, with synchronized stomping and clapping and chanting, ritualized movements of cutting an enemy's throat. You can see ordinary men transform themselves into something bigger, something greater. They're invoking a warrior spirit that does not accept defeat or dismay. It took a few viewings of the video, but my team of slightly out-of-shape computer programmers eventually started to talk about how they could be that way. They came up with four aspects worthy of emulation. The first was intense focus on the goal, built up and energized by the Maori chant. The second was radical collaboration, arms and bodies locked together, pushing for the same goal. The third was the hunger to crush. Anything in their way was to be obliterated. The fourth was universal excitement when any team member broke through with the ball. Who it was didn't matter. That it happened was cause for celebration. So we set up this framework of sprints and daily stand-up meetings and reviews and retrospectives. You will hear more about it in the appendix. And I realized we needed someone whose job it was to make sure the process itself was effective. Not a manager, more of a servant leader. Something between a team captain and a coach. As we were all watching the All Blacks every day, I asked the team what we should call this person. They decided on Scrum Master. He or she would facilitate all the meetings, make sure there was transparency, and most important, help the team discover what was getting in their way. The key part of that was to realize that often the impediments aren't simply that the machine doesn't work or that Jim in accounting is a jerk. It's the process itself. It was the Scrum Master's job to guide the team toward continuous improvement, to ask with regularity, how can we do what we do better? Ideally, at the end of each iteration, each sprint, the team would look closely at itself, at its interactions, practices, and processes, and ask two questions. What can we change about how we work? And what is our biggest sticking point? If those questions are answered forthrightly, a team can go faster than anyone ever imagined. Don't hate the player, hate the game. It often turns out that low team morale, cohesion, and productivity are based on a fundamental misunderstanding of how humans work. How many times have you gotten together with a colleague and started bitching about a third who isn't pulling her weight, or always slows us down, or makes stupid decisions? Or have you been with a group confronting a problem and the first thing that everyone does is try to fix blame? I'm willing to bet each and every one of you has been in a meeting like that. I'd also bet that each and every one of you, at one time or another, has been the person who has ended up being blamed for the problem. But I'd also be willing to bet that when you're blaming someone, you're finding fault with them personally. While if you are being blamed, you're much more aware of the situational factors that led to the problem and why you acted the way you did. And you know what? When you're talking about yourself, you're absolutely right. When talking about others, though, you're making one of the most common and destructive human errors in judging other people's actions. It even has a name: fundamental attribution error. Some fascinating studies related to this are laid out in the book Induction: Processes of Inference, Learning, and Discovery by John H. Holland et al. One paper cited in the book was published in the early 1970s, so this isn't new. This is old stuff that has been reproduced over and over and over again. It's all about what makes humans tick. Anyway, this group of researchers gathered together a bunch of male college students and asked them a couple of simple questions. Why did you choose your major? And why are you dating the person you are? And then the researchers asked their subjects to answer the same questions about their best friend. Important differences emerged. When the students talked about themselves, they talked not about themselves personally, but rather what they were asked about. They said such things as, "Chemistry is a high-paying field," about their major, and "She's a very warm person," about their girlfriend. But when they talked about their friends, they talked about their friends' abilities and needs. Things such as, "He was always good at math," or "He's kind of dependent and needs a take-charge kind of woman." This way of perceiving the world is funny when you see it in others. It's so obvious that they're making misjudgments. But before you laugh, you need to own up that you do it all the time as well. Everyone does. We all perceive ourselves as responding to a situation, while we see others as motivated by their character. One amusing side effect is that when we're asked to report on our personality traits and those of our friends, we always paint ourselves as far more boring. We say we have dramatically fewer character traits than our friends. The authors of Induction draw an interesting parallel between how we think mistakenly about social motivations and how non-scientists, or people with merely an intuitive understanding of physics, view the physical world. An intuitive physicist might explain why a rock falls by saying the rock itself has the intrinsic quality of gravity, rather than saying that gravity is part of a system of forces acting on the rock. In the same way, when we talk about others, we talk about their inherent properties rather than see those properties in relation to the external environment. In fact, it's those interactions with our environment that drive our behavior. It's the system that surrounds us rather than any intrinsic quality that accounts for the vast majority of our behavior. What Scrum is designed to do is change that system. Instead of looking for blame and fault, it rewards positive behavior by focusing people on working together and getting things done. Perhaps the most famous demonstration of this human reaction to systems was the Milgram experiment on obedience to authority figures, which was done in the early 1960s at Yale University. The experiment was simple and, to modern eyes,